Thank you, Billy. Just like that, huh?
That's it.
Okay. All right. Good evening, everybody. My name is Bill Wright. I'm a grateful alcoholic, and I'm living the dream. Like all of us in here. Like all of us in here that are sober by the grace of God, as manifested in the program and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for asking me to come down. And thanks to the gentleman whose car I was in, we had a nice little road trip to get down here, four of us, which is, you know, all part of the fellowship. Can everyone hear me? Am I supposed to speak into this thing here?
No. Speak where you want to.
Yeah,
Okay, all right. Well, let's see. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Well, I started out as a child. And the first photograph that I have, I don't have it anymore, but I remember the first photograph that I have of myself in anything but diapers, I've got this scowl on my face and I'm kicking a brick wall, you know, at like age 4 or 5, you know. So restless, irritable, discontent from the get-go, right out of the, you know, right out. And as soon as the solution presented itself, I took it, you know. But it was like in high school, you know. So I guess I came to this late. When I was in elementary school, I was born premature, so I was totally uncoordinated. I couldn't be participating in sports. And of course I had to control everything. And so no one liked me, and I was, you know, so I became a victim. Like, you know the story. So anyway, high school comes along, and I get in with a group of guys who invite me over to have a few beers. And the first time I got drunk then, I made a fool out of myself, acted like a camel, and they wanted me back. Now I had a group of people, you know, that was like me. And the second time I got drunk, I remember I threw up all over the place. And a couple of weeks later, I got drunk for the third time. And this time, I ended up in the police station for the first time. And it was kind of a repeat of the first one, because as the cop was having me, you know, he was taking down all the information. I couldn't see the desk. I got sick and puked all over the cop's desk where he was writing down all of this info. And that didn't bother me particularly. It was more that I had vomited on this beautiful suede coat that I had just shoplifted that week, you know. So, obviously I was not, I wasn't following my upbringing. You know, my parents were good. They were really good folks. You know, they had their issues, but they were loving parents. And they didn't really, well, my mom was a closet alcoholic. And I think the gene came from her directly. I mean, there are, on our father's side, all kinds of crazy stuff. Suicides and homicides and drunk, you know, bad stuff. So the gene, I guess it's the gene. I don't know how else to you know, because I didn't grow up around people drinking openly. So anyway, the solution to everything was, now I could dance, now I could, you know, be the life of the party. Now I could connect with anyone and everybody. And I remember one time we got, within a few months of my getting drinking for the first times, we got a case and we split it up, and I had like 2 beers left. You know, I get my Colt 45 or something after an evening or something. And I remember, you know, until that point, you know, I had a baseball bat, I had a coin collection, a stamp collection, and this collection, and that collection. All of that meant nothing anymore, because everything now was symbolized by these 2 beers. And I remember trying to figure out, well, where am I going to hide these, you know, from my folks, so that I can, you know, enjoy them at some future date, you know. And so I went outside and I buried them under a, you know, an old tree stump, you know, and come back in and lie down. I go, no, it's going to freeze out there, and then they'll blow up. So I go outside and I get them up, and I go down to the basement of our house, my parents' house, and I put them up in the rafters or something like that. And then I go lie down. You know, no, my mother will find it when she's sweeping up. You know, I must have re-hid those things 4 or 5 times. 2 stinking beer cans. So even though I was unable to become a daily drinker at that point, I was already a daily thinker about alcohol. It had replaced everything else, you know. I mean, for a few years then, because it was the late 60s, dope was easier to come by for me than, you know, an under 21. I didn't know smart people who had fake IDs. I didn't. So, I, you know, for a while I thought I was just a doper, you know, because it was easier to get. And that started me on a career of growing for about 10 years. Never made any money at it, but I did, you know, scrape by. And I graduated high school in a college town. My folks were both teachers. And so I just went to 13th grade. It was a college town, so I went to college. I didn't know what I was doing. Basically majoring in intro, you know, and but I was a terrible student because when push came to shove, I'd always get high or something, you know. And so I have to say that because of drugs and alcohol, I was able to get through my college career in only 4 terms. But that was Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter. So I, you know, that's my claim to fame. It took me that long. And, of course, I had to drop out and go here, go there. I mean, I had a magnificent career just handed to me in New York City. You know, I thought I was going to be an artist. Went to work for, you know, graphic designer Peter Max, and then these people that built sculptures for TV. And I mean, but I just drank it all away. I had a free place to live, and I just basically drank it all away. I couldn't show up because now I was in an environment where I could get drink any time of the day or night. You know, get off the train, walk upstairs, and there was the bar, you know. So it didn't last long. And a couple of years in New York, and I was, you know, I had to get a spiritual solution to this. And I remember somebody told me about Zen Buddhism and all this kind of stuff and meditation and macrobiotic diets and stuff. And so I gave away everything I owned. I had a car, gave away my stereo, gave all my clothes away, got a backpack, put some clothes in it, and I hitchhiked across Canada, all right? And I'm cooking up little things of brown rice, and I'm going to get spiritual, you know. I quit drinking, quit smoking cigarettes, you know. And I get all the way to the west coast of Vancouver Island, which is as far as you can go on a North American continent. And the last ride that I was with, you know, the guy picked me up, goes, "You want a beer?" And I go, "Sure." Just like that. Absolutely no resistance whatsoever, you know. Here I'd been, like, you know, in quest of, like, guruhood or something, you know what I mean, by being so, you know, abstinent. But, it, you know, so I was out there for a little while before it got too cold and rainy and had to come back to New York. But so anyway, I did get married, I remember, before I got married, I didn't know, again, what to do with my life. So we had a girlfriend, and we basically, each of us got together $1,000, and we hitchhiked around the Mediterranean for, you know, about 7 or 8 months. And for a good part of that time, I had to quit drinking because I got in trouble in Spain. Well, by the time we got around the Mediterranean and we're in Turkey, I just couldn't stop. Ran into an alcoholic Brit. And it just looked too good. So I started drinking again. Bad stuff started to happen. Boom, right away. You know, right away, bad stuff started to happen. And I'm just lucky I'm not in a Turkish jail. You know, like Midnight Express, that movie, you know. Like, it was just that bad real quick. Anyway, so I did get married. But... Bus in Turkey. Marcello wants me to tell a story, and let me just digress a minute. We were in Aleppo, you know, in Syria, and we were trying to get to Turkey, and there was a bus. It was all painted psychedelic colors and a picture of a strong man on the side of it. And we go, you know, it was just in a parking lot. We go and knock on the door of the bus, and the thing goes open, and a bunch of drunk Greeks in there. "Hi, come on in, have some ouzo," you know. And so we're all drinking, having a great old time, and the bus keeps going, shaking, you know. "What the hell's that? What's that?" And this big, burly, you know, weightlifting guy goes, "Oh, that's Johnny." "Johnny.
You want to see Johnny?
Sure. Where's Johnny? He's in the back. It's like a school bus that's been divided halfway, you know. So curtains drawn back, and there's a freaking gorilla, you know, in the behind bars in the back of this school bus.
Let's go drink with Johnny. Okay.
You know, so we all go back, and we're pouring shots of ouzo for Johnny the gorilla, and it went downhill from there. That's all I can tell you. It's just, okay, enough out of, I'm sorry to be distracted, but that was, you know, that's life of an alcoholic. Like, hey, let's go there. Hey, you know, hey, let's go to Tijuana. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, it's midnight. What's going on? I don't know. Let's go to New York. You know, the stupid. Anyway, so at some point, I remember living in a farmhouse with no indoor plumbing, you know, $100 a month, and I was growing dope out in the fields. That was my only income, and I wasn't really making any money from that because I was smoking it and eating it, and I was brewing beer in a 5-gallon garbage can and drinking it after 2 days of capping it, and it was because it was free, you know, not that it was, and I remember just getting really mad one night and busting shit up and sitting there smoking a cigarette and there was a naked light bulb just sitting there. You know, that was the only light in that kitchen. I'm smoking a cigarette and the light just goes out. I'm going, God damn it. And the bee that had been going around and around that light bulb came over and stung me on the neck. And, you know, he just comes after the cigarette or something. Somehow, I got to quit drinking. This is the first time it occurred to me I should stop drinking. You know, because look at my circumstances. You know, I'm not too far from eating food out of a can, you know what I mean? And so I quit drinking, but on the strength of willpower alone. Joined the Peace Corps with my new wife, because we went to the Middle East where there was, you know, no drinking, basically, unless you wanted that sweet perfume, and I wasn't into that. And so for a couple of years I went there. It was good. But let me tell you something. An alcoholic without a program is just going to be a dry drunk. But I was the worst dry drunk. I was just a steel spring that was just being compressed, you know? I mean, with no solution. You know, alcohol was my solution. That was the only way that I could get that, you know? And without that, I just got weirder and weirder. And so our marriage kind of dissolved when we finished the Peace Corps. Well, I knew how to fix that problem. Back to drinking. After 2 years of not, you know, about 2+ years of not drinking, I started drinking again. And it was 18 years before it occurred to me that I had to try and quit drinking again. I mean, that's how powerful alcohol is, you know. So I didn't try, you know, it was only 2 or 3 times that I ever really tried to quit drinking. And obviously, it was just waiting on my own, just waiting for a crisis or complacency to get me drinking again. However, because of that period of abstinence from alcohol, dope just went away. I couldn't smoke anymore because it gave me the fear, you know. Without being able to drink to sleep, I just was a nervous wreck from trying to smoke. So I quit doing that. It just went away. Miraculously. And so now I can actually hold a job because all I'm doing is drinking. I'm not just staying stoned all day long. I'm just drinking, you know. And, you know, a lot of those are functional alcoholics. I became a functional alcoholic teacher. And I had a great time. You know, I was a little bit, I don't know who was the more mature in the classroom, whether it was myself or whether it was the high school students that I was teaching. Sometimes it really was them, you know. And but they loved me there. They, you know, I mean, I was teaching, English as a second language to a refugee population. And a lot of these kids were coming out of war zones and terrible situations where they were just like zombies, you know. And so I got them you know, I woke him up, man. I was making a joke with Sam here about paper wads. I trained kids how to make paper wads so we could have battles in the classroom, you know, so that they could get, you know, I mean, socialized to having some kind of good, clean fun, you know. Anyway, so that was just, I'm just saying that was one of the deals. But we had a great, you know, I had a lot of respect from the faculty and from the administration because of what I was doing. I mean, I was just amped up, you know. And, well, you know, you keep doing this, and then, but you know, day after day, I'd go there, and, you know, it's showtime. And then I'd go home, and then the next morning I'd get up, and it's showtime. And then over, you know, a few more years, it was like, showtime. because I was drinking more and unable to recover, you know. I mean, I was trying my damnedest. I was a controlled drinker. I'd go in there, I'd get home and I'd start slamming them down. And I drink with great abandon until, you know, I don't know, 7 o'clock or something like that. Time for dinner. And I would just try and, you know, do the breaks. And I, you know, that was just torment, that time of having to stop drinking. But I knew if I didn't do that, I would not be able to keep a job, keep a house, and a beautiful wife with 3 beautiful daughters. There was no chance that any of that could be possible if I was going to be able to drink the way I wanted to drink. Nah. So I had to do this controlled drinking thing. But the longer I did, you know, sooner or later, it kind of got, you know, I mean, at first it was just beers. Then it was shots and beers. Then it was shots and beers and wine with dinner. And let me tell you, all 3 food groups, you're not going to be able to recover, you know, a good from a, you know, the hangovers were not debilitating, but it was progressively, you know, I was never really sober. I didn't realize that until I came in here, you know. I thought, well, you woke up, you know, you're sober because you're not drinking, you know. But when I stopped drinking, I was no longer having those little fender benders that I was having during the day. You know, I'd be driving down the road, bang, you know, I mean, how did that happen? What, you know, I mean, because I just wasn't conscious, I wasn't focused, I wasn't attentive. And that stopped when I got drunk, when I got sober. Well, anyway, the kid, you know, the longer, for me, the tragedy of my alcoholism, I'm just a chicken shit drinker, as you can well see. You know, it was like, you know, I went from being, you know, dancing on tables to just going, what the hell's happened in my life? You know, well, I'm trapped and shit. I remember it was like a February night, February morning, and it had sleeted a little bit. And I went outside and bare feet just to test the ground and see if it was slippery. Yeah, it was slippery. Good, I can call in sick. So I called in sick, you know, because it was too dangerous for me to drive to school. So I'm sitting there at the breakfast table. My 3 little daughters are there, and my wife is sitting there, and they're all chatting away. I'm just looking out the window going, I hate my life. I'm trapped. I can't do anything. Everything is miserable. Everybody hates me. I hate everybody. I mean, it was just like one of those things, you know. And my youngest daughter is sitting there going, Daddy stayed home to be with us, but it's like he's not even here at all. You know? That was absolutely true, you know. I mean, it wasn't but 2 weeks later after that incident that they came to me. Because I was now in the, like I said, the tragedy of my alcoholism was the longer I drank, the less I was able to handle ordinary reality. It became untenable to not be drunk. So I was going to school and trying to behave normally when I really just wanted to be hammered, you know what I mean? And so it just, like that steel spring, it started to happen even though I was drinking at night. I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't relieve the anxiety. And so I was having some bad behavior in the classroom. You know, I was throwing kids out. I was throwing their books out. I was throwing the chairs out after them, throwing the desks out of the room. If you're right next to the assistant principal's office, this shit gets noticed. And so they came to me and said, we don't know what's going on, but we're sending you to employee's assistance. I go, okay. All right, well, So I go to employee's assistance, and for some reason she gets me to tell the truth, you know, how much you drink, and I go, why would you know I'm not, you know, why would you know I'm not? Anyway, so I told her, and she goes, well, I think you need some informational interviewing at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go, oh, you know, how can I possibly, I can't possibly be an alcoholic. Look, I'm controlling it. I'm not drinking all day long, you know. I mean, there was a time when I was living in New York when I'd gotten so kind of discouraged that I was panhandling for wine on the streets, you know. And in fact, you know, there's a passage in here where Ebbie Thatcher comes to Bill Wilson's house, you know, on Clinton Street in Brooklyn. I used to panhandle on Clinton Street right outside his house. I didn't know that until I got here, you know. Anyway, so, you know, but that was all more of a joke, a goof, you know what I mean? I was doing it to be a part of, you know, a part of what? Well, of a community of mentally ill people, you know, those guys that are on the street with the squeegees and stuff. They're there not because they're, you know, CEOs that something bad happened. They're mentally, you know, a lot of them have real issues. Anyway, so I didn't have issues. I was just a drunk. And so they sent me to employee's assistance. I tell her what's going on, and she tells me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go, oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. But there was no way around it. I mean, if it was either Alcoholics Anonymous or no, you know, I'd lose the job, I'd lose the house, lose the family, lose the wife. I mean, it was... So I go to Alcoholics. I go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Unity Club in Falls Church. An afternoon meeting on the way home from school. It was like a 2 o'clock meeting. And I get in there, and I sit down, and this guy starts talking about hiding bottles. I go, yeah. Next guy talked about wrecking a car. I go, yeah. Next guy lost a job. Yeah. You know, and then the next guy lost a marriage. Uh-huh. Next guy, I don't even know. I mean, it was like, just every person that was talking, I could relate to what alcohol had done to them in their lives. It was exactly what I had experienced. I never heard this at the lunchroom. You know, people tell me, "Hey, let's go and have a little drinky poo after school." You know, and it was like, no, I was, you know, now I was hearing people experiencing alcohol and alcoholism the way I had experienced it, and I immediately identified. I immediately knew, you know, that this was the solution I had been looking for my entire life. I was astounded. I mean, I'm going, this has been here all along, you know? I never would have found it by myself because the idea of it, I was such a, you know, so dishonored. Well, you know, I just didn't want to even countenance the idea because to me, the way I'd been brought up, alcohol was not a disease. It was a moral failing. I was it was moral turpitude or something that why people drank the way they drank. But I heard that it's a disease. I heard it that it was an illness, perhaps a genetic disorder. And I also heard the solution. And for some reason, I just knew that this is going to be where I... you know, where I belong. And so I started going to meetings every day. I got a sponsor back in Warrenton and in Marshall. And I went to meetings every day. I started the 90 and 90. And I went to 90-90 for 8 years. Yeah, I could count on these hands the number of meetings I missed in 8 years. It was absolutely necessary for me. I was afraid. I was so afraid of... But, you know, it wasn't just fear of drinking. What we have in here is so phenomenal. It's such a prescription for a way of living. I could not have guessed when I walked into my first meeting. So my first sponsor and I went through the we took the steps in that first year. He had me doing a lot of service work. I was a secretary for a men's retreat group, and that's where I met Billy for the first time. He was in a wheelchair the first time I saw him. It was really great. Great to see you again. And so, you know, that kind of making coffee and then and being a GSR. I really liked being a GSR. I don't think I want to do it again because I don't like sleeping in hotel rooms necessarily, but, you know, for the assemblies. But when I went to those assemblies, it was like watching spiritual politics. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, you watch people, you know, so graciously apologize for behaviors that are just seemingly normal. And you see the minority opinion being respected and people go, yeah, yeah. It was just like, you know, boy, I just wish the whole world could run like this. So that first month of sobriety for me was just like, it was like I was walking on air. I hear people, I remember Bill Johnson's story of seeing the robins, you know, and Cowboy's story of seeing the green grass for the first time. For me, it was seeing the light in people's eyes. I would walk down the street and everyone was smiling at me. And everyone had this glow of life force that I could see just coming out of their eyes. I don't know how to explain it. It was just like all of a sudden I was living in a parallel universe or something, because it was so wonderful to be sober. But not just not drinking. It was because I was in the program, in the center of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what gave me that insight, you know. So I did, I took the steps. I remember the fourth step I took, that was easy for me because, you know, people say, I don't know, how am I going to get started? I sat down, my sponsor told me, go to where you used to drink a lot and take your yellow pad and start, you know, with the columns like they do in a big book. So I did that. And I came up with, I had 103 names in a month. You know, it was basically everyone that I had ever known I had a resentment about. You know, every single one of them. But he didn't want to see that when we did the fifth. He didn't want to look at any of that. He just said, give me the big ones, you know. So we did that. And then to do the eighth step, he just looked at the list and said, half of these people, you're imagining this, but you want to do this, you want to do that, you want to do this, you know. He told me, like, for example, some of them, he just said, write the letter and don't send it, because it'll be too much anxiousness for the people that you're trying to, you know, settle the score with. Some of it was like I had to do anonymous donations of cash because I had stolen stuff, you know. The one place that I did, you know, there was one grocery store, I think I had to go in and I went up to the gal, you know, and I did what they told me. I get down on my knees outside the store and just ask God to bless me, that I'm doing this for the right reason. So I go in and I see the manager. I got to talk to the manager. I say, I have to make restitution for what I stole so I could stay sober. And she looked at me. We both started crying. And she goes, don't worry, honey. My husband's in the program, too. I understand. Woo! So I got out of that one. And she just wanted a donation to the welfare of the employees' welfare thing, you know. But there were a lot of $100 bills that went in the red bucket at Christmas time, you know, that year. For, you know, to try and, you know, make an amend. And I still make, my sponsor also taught me how to, you know, start writing checks to charities and stuff. I never wrote. Anyway. I was a GSR. I've always seemed to have a service position of some kind. They said it was good to stay in the center of AA so you don't fly off, you know, so you don't have a tangential issue. And that's worked for me. Right now I'm on the board of what is the closest thing to a clubhouse in Warrenton. It's called the Meeting Place. We don't call it a clubhouse because it's just, you know, we provide a place for 12-step meetings, you know, OA, NA, and all that. And that's been a lot of fun to be in the center of that. But I haven't made, you know, every time I get a coffee job, some newcomer comes along and says, all right, get out of the way. We need to keep this guy sober. He can't make coffee anymore. The new guy's got to make the coffee, you know. So I've run out of shit to say, to be honest with you, but I find something here. In the, I've been sober now for over 19 years. I'm grateful that I was that I'm a first nighter. Not because I don't say that to brag. I was just ready. When I got here after 30 years of daily drinking, I was ready for the message. And the example of our founders is that some people get it the first time, others people get it later, like Dr. Bob. And there's no difference. I mean, sometimes I wonder if I would have gotten any more out of going back out. Honestly, you know? I remember talking to a meeting once going, you know, all those guys that really went down, low bottom drunks, they seem to all have that white light spiritual experience like Bill W. was talking about. And I said, I wish I had had that. And this guy goes, hey, I think that's a good idea. Why don't you go try it, you know? So he cured me of thinking on that line. I have a neighbor who's kind of challenging. I've got a little bit of property, and there was a fence. He had cattle. I'm not nothing. And he wanted to put a new fence in there, and we did a survey, and, didn't really know where it was, but he wanted to put the fence in there that day. And I go, well, can't we just wait till we clarify where the boundary line really is? He goes, you know, you don't like that? Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to put a fence in here, and then I'll put a pigsty right there, right next to your house. How do you like that? How do you like that? We'll just put the fence along where the old fence line was. Well, it turns out we did another survey a year or so later, and the property line is like 15 feet. You know, he's got 15 feet of my property. And I go, well, we got to do something about this. And I go, Doc, you know, can we move the fence? He goes, I'll see you in court. Ah, you know, and this guy's got pictures in the paper for litigation. I mean, he's one of these guys, you know, has a resentment streak. So, you know, I talked to my sponsor, and I started praying about him, you know, which is what, I'll tell you, 552 is the greatest thing that I ever got out of this book. I went right to it. I mean, you know, you have a resentment, you pray for the person you resent, and it'll fix it. And it's always worked. Not right in 2 weeks like it says in here, but it's always worked. So I prayed for this guy. Somehow or another, a mutual friend interceded, and he came to me and said, well, I'll tell you what, let's split the cost of moving the fence. I go, okay. I didn't want to. I mean, it was his egregious error that, you know. But I put up the $2,000 just so that I wouldn't have the resentment living in my head. And I got 15 more extra feet. About a quarter of an acre. And I put boxwood in there. And I'm going to sell those boxwood and I'll recoup all that money eventually. You know. But it was the whole idea. I saw him once. I was driving on our little country dirt road. And he's standing there. I mean, he was in a truck, and I came flying up over the hill, and he goes, why don't you slow down? I'm going to get the cops on you. Blah, blah, blah. And I just, so I just go, goodbye. And I drive off. Well, about a week later, and of course now it's in my head, when I see him again, what am I going to say? When I see him, then I'm going to say this, then he's going to say that, and then I'm going to say this, and then I'm going to do that, and then I, you know, and then I'll, yeah, I'm going to shoot flaming arrows into his round bales and burn them. And so I don't know what caused me to walk to the mailbox. It's a half a mile away. I just decided to get to, hey, it's a beautiful day, I'll go walk. So I'm walking to the mailbox. He drives up and goes, what did you say to me last time? I go, and before I could say whatever, he says, goodbye. now I'm burning, you know, I'm going. now it's not just flaming arrows. I mean, you know, but, you know, I did what I talked to the sponsor, talked to this, and continued to pray for this guy. And the very next time I saw him, I'm driving, I said, hey, Doc, I owe you an apology. You know, you were absolutely right. I was I was going too fast, and I'll try and be, it almost hurt to do that, but it really didn't, because as soon as I said that, I didn't have to think about that guy again. It was gone, completely gone. I mean, all of this, none of these behaviors are, you know, or could I have ever come up with myself. I told you that I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was throwing kids out of the classroom, yelling at them, making a big ass out of myself and everybody else. And, oh shit, I still remember. I went to my first assembly, first Virginia convention, and I saw my secretary from the main office sitting down there. And I go up to her, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And she goes, you have no idea how many meetings they were having about you. You know, really, not only would I have missed this, who knows? You know, who knows what it would have been? So anyway, I got here because I was of bad behavior. I was sent here because I was misbehaving in school. So I actually made it to retirement. And in 2 years of retirement, you know, after about 2 years of working on a house, working on a property, I built a big barn, you know. And that's another story. I started on a barn, the biggest tree on my property smashed it during a hurricane. And when I walked down to look at it, I go, instead of, yeah, you know, I just went, God, what is the message? What do you know? Every setback is a setup. I know that. What's the silver lining from this? Well, the insurance guy gave me four times what I put into this little cheesy barn, and I was able to build a barn that was five times bigger. You know, with the money that he, I mean, it's, anyway. So, like I said, I was thrown, I almost lost my job because of bad behavior. But I retire, work on the house, work on this barn, have a great meal thing going, and I ran out of walk-around money. So I decided to go back to teaching. But this time I'm going to go local. Instead of driving to Arlington every day, I'm working in Warrenton. And in a middle school instead of a high school. And that was fun, too. I mean, I really enjoyed those kids. They were really a lot of fun to watch. I mean, just a youthful, just the vitality of kids was so marvelous, a littler, you know. Anyway, so one day this little sixth grader comes up to me and says, Mr. Wright, you're unique. You know that? And I go, oh, no, what is he going to tell me? What's he going to tell me now? You know? And he goes, you're the only teacher in this school that doesn't yell at the students. And I go, I mean, I didn't go to good teacher school. I didn't take classes on how to be a more sane, you know, I came to AA. And that was the product, you know? I came to AA. I've more and more come to trust prayer and meditation, but mostly prayer. Whenever I do anything of late, it's just like, thy will be done. Why? Because I immediately know someone's got my back, and I don't have to do any of this alone. I guess that's third step. You know, I guess I do third step all the time now. Because it really, it really works. It obviously, it just works. You know, when I was in high school, I remember there was an assistant administrator who took a bad shine to me. I mean, it was like I was in the middle of I was teaching computers in this computer classroom, and I, oh shit, I got to get down to the library to grab something. I need something for this class. So I just said, all right, you guys, I'll be back in a minute. I took off down the hall. I mean, and I get back and the administrators, you left them alone with the computers, and I almost told her. They don't need my help to go to all the pornography sites. They can find that by themselves, you know. But I didn't say that, but she got really, you know, toasted that I had left the classroom and wasn't, you know. And for a year, it was like she was trying to get me fired, trying to get me, I don't know, it was really like, whoa, you know, here. I had only been used to being, you know, been told how great I was. And now I'm being told, you know, so what do I do? What they told me here, get down and start praying for them. And I was praying for her constantly. Not, you know, not every day, but consistently. And by the end of like 9 or 10 months, she was my greatest booster in that school. And again, I made no effort to change any of my behavior, you know. And I'm sure she didn't either. We didn't do anything about talking to each other. It was never any. But because I did those things that I learned here, you know, everything kind of changed. I had the opportunity recently to help to be a part of a back to basics course at the Warrenton Meeting Place. And if you don't know what that is, well, it's not. I just learned now. It's not conference approved, but it's like a kind of a big book shorthand and a jump start. And you take the steps of the program in a month, and in four meetings. And for people that are having a hard time getting started, I think it's a good idea. Maybe it's not exactly AA and everyone. I mean, but nonetheless, I'm really grateful I had the opportunity to do that, because I got an awful lot out of it. I did a fourth and a fifth to learn how to do a fourth and a fifth with a guy that wanted to do a fourth and a fifth with me. I had to go do another one. And I had thought, you know, I did a great fourth and a fifth 18 years ago. I never need to do that again, you know. Well, I got to do it again, and I saw, whoa, so much more. And it wasn't because I had to have 103 names. I had only 9 or 10 names. But the way we did it was, instead of me writing down my list and giving it and doing a fifth step that way, I sat down with a guy at Panera, you know, over a cup of coffee, and I just talked about the 10 people that were in my life now that were bothering me. And he listened and he said, that sounds like a resentment. That sounds like self-pity. That sounds like, you know, false pride. And at the end, he always checks in, and I see patterns that I had never been able to see before. So I found very great value in that, in doing that program. And we had about 45 people doing that. Now, I guess really, I've kind of like evolved. I've changed drunken behaviors, drunken routines, into sober routines. I think a day at a time for me doesn't mean, you know, I'm not drinking today. Or doesn't mean like, it means doing something positive for my sobriety every single day. I may not get to a meeting every day like I used to, but I do something for my sobriety every day. My first cup of coffee gets put next to 3 meditation books. And I may not even remember what's on the pages of those meditation books 5 minutes after I read them. But the marker is on the right, is always on the right page, because it was there yesterday. And that's what's important about it. I can't meditate. I've tried. I keep going and doing. I just simply can't feel happy about trying to still my mind. But I'm conscious of, but it doesn't mean I'm not trying to be attentive. More attentive. Sometimes I think that the only relief that I get from the anxiety of just being me is in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know. Nah, not exactly. I've got more than that. But that's one place I can surely expect to find it, because I'm not coming to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with any expectation other than to listen to you all, you know. When I'm in your presence, I behave better, and I'm much, you know, much more conscious of being the person that God intended me to be. So I have my 3 meditation books in the morning. Usually I'll get a call from someone, or I'll call somebody that hasn't been, you know. I'll plan on a meeting, and if I can't get to a meeting, I'll make an extra call. Then I've got a chip in my pocket, and when I walk around during the day and fumble around for change, there it is. Ah! And that restarts my day. It restarts my day, because it reminds me that the most important thing in my life really is sobriety. It really is. I mean, because on that basis, on the basis of sobriety, all of my other behaviors depend. All of my behaviors of being a better, trying to be a better husband and all that stuff, you know? Just being so aware. I went shopping last week. You know, it's fallen to me. I'm only a part-time teacher now. I'm working at before I got to the Gorilla you know, in Turkey. I remember I was at this island on Greece, and we'd been hitchhiking late at night, and we got picked up by the mayor of a town. We go to this guy's house, and then we were just feted for the next 3 days. You know, we're the only Americans. You know, there had just been a war between Greece and Turkey, so there wasn't a lot of tourists. And so we had the greatest party in time, I swear to God. I remember one morning I was kind of hungover, get out of his house. Across the road from his house was this hillock, and on top of the hill was a ruined Venetian fort from the 15th century. And I went up there just to kind of look around. I looked down, and there's a ruined Roman Greco-Roman temple, you know, next to a minaret from a mosque that the Turks had built when they had occupied Greece. And then there was some other stuff, and I'm just going, wow, I'm going to go back to the United States, and I'm going to teach history. I'm really inspired to do that. Well, I'm finally doing that. It only took 40 years. It only took 40 years. I mean, it was in God's time, you know. I mean, I taught English as a second language to all the kids from, you know, from kindergarten to high school for over 30 years. Had a great time doing that. I was designed to do that. I was given that gift to be able to do that. And now, I'm too old to discipline. I'm definitely too old to start throwing chairs at the roof. But so I've been teaching at a community college, just world history, you know? Anyway, I mean, thank you, God. I mean, it's just like, here you are, you know? Just like, it wasn't in my time, but it's happened nonetheless. And that's a gift of the program. I never could have gone back to school for an advanced degree so that I could do this if I hadn't been sober. You know, I mean, and I did. I acquitted myself quite well when I went back. I even got an award for teaching. I think they paid me $1,000 for just writing something. That was pretty cool. You know, I'm all over. I thought I was going to be more organized when I was going to tell you my quote story, but it occurs to me that's not what's coming out of my mouth. Perhaps I should have made some kind of organized outline so that it would have made more sense to me. But you know, it always occurred, you know, the whole idea of speaking, I used to think, I go to a speaker, I love going to speaker meetings because, you know, I'm going to hear some wisdom that's going to give me the key to stay sober. And that may be true to some extent, but I think it's more about, I'm so appreciative that you all turned out to help me stay sober. Because for me, you know, I hear myself say stuff that I couldn't have thought about. It became words instead of just random thoughts. So I'm kind of reorganizing them in that regard. I got a couple of people who are deluded enough to call me a sponsor, but I am so grateful for the opportunity to do road trips with them. Right now, I have a guy. There's a guy moved. I'm on a real, real country road, and there's a guy that lives right up the lane from me. He's been real busy as a government worker with the hurricane relief, so we haven't been doing a lot. But and then there's another guy about a mile away, another newcomer, and it's like the three amigos, you know. We get to ride to meetings. And the whole thing is just one big yuck fest, you know, getting in the car and going to the meeting and then coming back from the meeting. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I haven't had that opportunity in a while, you know. My first sponsor went back out. It took him a while for us to figure this out, you know, that he was showing up smelling like mouthwash for a year until we've confronted him, you know. And so I found a new sponsor that week. And my new sponsor that I found that week, and I had a marvelous relationship. He lived for maybe 3 miles away. He and his wife was in Al-Anon. My wife was in Al-Anon. My wife and his wife, the gals would get together, and they would have their road trip to the Monday night Al-Anon meeting. I think it was really important, by the way, for my wife to have experienced something of AA that way, Because if you don't grow together, you grow apart. And she and it had such a profound effect on me. How could I not expect, you know? I'm a member of, I don't know what I started to talk about, but I have, here's a new thought, it just popped in my head. I'm a member of a church. I joined a church not because I'm, you know, a religious guy. I joined a church because I wanted to give my three little girls some kind of moral literacy, you know? And besides, they got to be raised by a whole gigantic dysfunctional family instead of just a nuclear dysfunctional family. You know, is how I look at it. You know, it was a good deal, but it's turned out to be even more. AA, like I said, had such a profound effect on me that within a week of me going to my first bunch of meetings and talking and being in church, people were calling the house. You know, what's happened to him? What's going on? What happened to him? And my wife said, oh, he's in AA now, you know. So I never had any anonymity whatsoever with that population, with that community. And it's worked out fantastically because I've been able to take people to their first meeting from ages 17 to 70. 70 to their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to be honest with you, they've all managed to stay, not because of me, but they've all managed to stay sober. There's a young man who calls me. He got sober at 19. I've got a Christmas tree farm. He was thrown out of school for selling crack and drinking, and his life was just in the absolute toilet. He was facing jail time. He was facing all this. He came to the farm with his mom, you know, and we start talking. He's just like standing there like a zombie, you know, that's been just hit by a baseball bat. And I started just talking. I mean, he was just talking about why he was being thrown out. And I just told him about the disease concept of alcoholism. You're not a bad guy. You just can't not drink, man. You know, and he was just like, yeah, that's me too. That's me. He's still sober, you know, because it was the perfect storm for him, and I happened to be in the right place. You know, God put me in the right place to be able to do that. And again, he was from the church. So sometimes I think my real reason to be a member of the church is to try and be that big book that, you know, people get the opportunity to see. Now, that was a tangential idea, and I don't remember what the first idea was. maybe it'll come back to me, but maybe it won't. Maybe it's not important. So I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the most important thing in my life. You know, I guess it's all about gratitude. And that recent fourth and fifth step that I did, I found out that I had a lot of false pride. And it wasn't false pride because, oh, I'm so great. It was because, why do I keep doing the same stupid shit all the time? Why can't I get better? I was expecting perfection, you know? I was expecting so. I don't know if you can relate to trying to be a perfectionist, but, you know, I think that's probably a lot of us do that. And I never saw that before, and I got to see that, you know? And so I'm trying to be conscious of it and just going, I will be done. Thank you, God. You know. Anyway, you told me to quit, and I actually filled up the time that you gave. I'm surprised. I really am. But God bless you all, and I'm so grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful that you're all here tonight sober like me. All right.